Session number 9484.
Mr. Russell, rail 4. So, how long did you have for leave?
Well, we were supposed to be pulled out for reorganisation, but we only had, as far as I can remember, it was less than a week, and it was only a few days. We didn't know of Madrid, and so I had got very friendly with Jock Cunningham, and we had been given some pay. We got 10 pesetas a day, and we took a tram to the only place that we'd heard of, which was the Puerta del Sol in the centre of Madrid. And when we got out there, we didn't know much what to do, but everybody seemed to be having their shoes shine, so we went along and place and our shoes shine, our shoe boots shined. And we were talking, and a chap came up to us and asked if we were British, and it turned out that he was Sefton Delmer, who was the correspondent of the Daily Express at that time, and was very enthusiastic and excited, having come across some British. He had heard that there were foreigners there, but hadn't come across any British. So immediately invited us to have lunch with him, which we did. He took us to a restaurant, we had lunch, and then took us to the Telefonica building. And the Telefonica, which of course is still there, was the place where all the foreign correspondents met and where they went to phone their dispatches and stories. Well, Jock and I had, during the lunch, made up our minds that we weren't going to tell anything to Sefton Delmer, because we were very suspicious of him being in the Daily Express and right wing and all that. When we got to the Telefonica, Sefton Delmer introduced us to various people, including Geoffrey Cox, who at that time was the correspondent of the News Chronicle. Well, he's now Sir Geoffrey Cox, and was head of ITN, or formed Independent Television News when it was first formed, and then was for some years head of Yorkshire Television. And we were very pleased that we met Geoffrey, and being from the News Chronicle, we, much to Sefton Delmer's annoyance and anger, we told Geoffrey Cox the story of who we were and about the British unit in the International Brigade there. And in fact, you'll see an account of it in Geoffrey Cox's book, Left Book Club, Defence of Madrid. I think, well, he mentions me and Jock Cunningham, and mentions me there in my OTC uniform and all that. So that was sort of a first encounter, and in fact, Geoffrey Cox was the first correspondent to have reported the existence of the British in the International Brigade. Frank Pitcairn was there for the Daily Worker, and he found out later. It was rather strange, but anyhow, it's one of those things that. Well, we.
If I can just stop you there, you refused to give Sefton Delmer this information because he came from the Daily Express, but you said he was enthusiastic. Do you think that was just a cover, or was that his
Oh, no.
genuine personal enthusiasm?
Well, his enthusiasm, I mean, the point of view of a journalist, as any journalist would, as having come, really got the first story of the British volunteers in Spain. Any journalist, he always look for, in a story like that, a British angle. And here it was, you see, and there'd been apparently various rumours about foreigners, and the journalist really didn't know what to make of this business of the foreigners or the International Brigade. And so here there was, in journalistic terms, a scoop. And he was enthusiastic from that point of view. I mean, didn't say he was enthusiastic for the Republican cause. He was just enthusiastic, as you know, understandably, as a professional journalist. And understandably also, damn annoyed at having given us a great lunch. It's true that, no doubt, as all journalists, he put the lunch on expenses, plus a little bit for himself, but... and then Geoffrey Cox got the story.
So, but his own political views didn't come across when you met him?
No, no. I mean, we were suspicious because of the paper he worked for, the Daily Express, being notoriously right-wing, and the News Chronicle, as you know, very liberal paper, and supporters of the Republic, as we knew too, and against Franco.
Did you say you came across Frank Pitcairn that, then and there?
No, no, I actually never came across personally Frank Pitcairn in Spain. But I knew he was there, because we had started getting a Daily Worker, and so we saw his reports. So after these few days, we went back in the line, and the fighting got even heavier. But we were then pulled out of the line from Madrid. Those of us who left were survived. I've forgotten the actual date again, but it was just before Christmas, about the 20th or 21st of December. And those of us who survived were taken back to Albacete, where we were put into the... And then we discovered what we... Oh, yes, we had met the other British unit, who... His main bloke who was there was Giles Romilly, who was the British unit, was with the Tailman Battalion, who had been also in very heavy fighting at Boadilla del Monte, which, of course, Giles wrote about in that, his book on Spain. So those of us who survived were joined up to form this first English company that was put into the 12th, into a another French battalion that went to Cordoba, on the Cordoba front. We were only a few days there together, and we went by train down south, detrained at a place called Andújar, A-N-D-U-J-A-R, and then in trucks up to the Cordoba front. That was a disastrous area. Well, it became the history of the international brigades afterwards, that we were put in the most difficult areas of the front, where the danger was greatest, whether it was on the defensive or in an offensive, and suffered heavy casualties as a result. The we were attacked while we were still in trucks by plane. We were strafed by planes, machine gun from the air, and lost quite a few people. Got out of the trucks pretty fast. We were in action around a village called Lopera, L-O-P-E-R-A, and the first English company was commanded by Major Nathan, who then became very well known and a gallant officer. And the first man I had ever seen who was this sort of legendary type of officer with his pipe in his mouth, Sam Brown belt, and swagger stick under his arm, walking around when the shit was flying. Wouldn't even put his head down. And we advanced and then discovered that we were in open country, olive groves. Whether we had advanced further than we should have done, but anyhow, we then were under fire, not only from the fascist troops opposite us, but then we discovered from our own machine gun company were behind and on one flank. It was there that I was wounded and John Cornford was killed, Ralph Fox was killed about 100 yards from where I was wounded. And with the help of Jock Cunningham, managed to get back. I was lying around in no man's land for a bit, but Jock Cunningham pulled me out, and as I told you earlier, finally got the stretcher. Well, the commander of that battalion was a Frenchman called de La Salle. And there was a hell of a row around him later on, because de La Salle was then, after this fiasco, was arrested. And it was claimed, was found to have fascist documentation on him. Then there was a later story that he was a member of the French Deuxième Bureau. What the rights of that was, I don't know. But anyhow, he was court-martialed and shot. And there was a tremendous row of the at the time in France about it. His widow, understandably, was very angry and upset. And the case was taken up in French Parliament. Well, at that time, André Marty, who was one of the organisers of the International Brigade, was a French communist deputy in the French Parliament, and was supposed to have been responsible for the execution, or ordering the execution of this battalion commander, and there was a great row about it. But of course I didn't know about that later, except that when I was in hospital in Linares, as I told you earlier, I was questioned about the whole incident and how, what had happened and all that. Well, we again suffered very heavy casualties, but then that was really the end of the war for me.
Could I ask you exactly how you were wounded? Can you describe it?
Well, yes, I was lying on the ground and firing away, and suddenly I felt this knock, which I thought, well, something had fallen on me. And then I got up to run forward and then fell, and then realized that I couldn't walk, that something, and then I saw the blood coming out of my boot, and at the same time felt blood on my back, and I just couldn't move. I shouted out to Jock, I've been hit. And by that time, Jock had, the company had fallen back. And then Jock ran forward and pulled me out, got hold of one leg and pulled me out. And so, with his help, crawled until we found a stretcher. And it was there that, after I was wounded, before I'd found and got a stretcher, that I met for the first time General Walter, or Walter, whose real name we discovered years later was Swierczewski, a Polish military man, who, as far as I know, had entered into, it was his first action in command of the division, as a divisional commander on that front. I forgot what the number of the division was. So, in what happened, I got a pretty good idea, well, from my own experience, of the lamentable state of the medical service there, the shortage of. We each had a, what do you call it, first aid dressing. Just to find a stretcher bearer, a stretcher was very, very difficult. Which made me all the more angry when subsequently I went to Barcelona and found, this was in February, March 37, at the place full of large quantities of weapons, arms, artillery, brand new ambulances, riding around, people riding around in Barcelona, whereas we at the front were absolutely short of everything.
Who did you blame for that?
Well, for me, it was mostly what I saw in Barcelona, the anarchists who had all this weaponry and material in them. I particularly remember the people who were going around with a black and red armband, some with a black and sort of red skull and crossbones, and with a slogan, "Sin amor, sin Dios," no love and no God. And on that Cordoba front, the wounded, those who couldn't be taken by stretcher, there were no ambulances, were taken away from the front in agricultural dung carts. Carts that were used for spreading dung in the fields and that.
When you were wounded yourself, were you able to see the enemy who'd done it?
Yes, there were. It's a sort of undulating country there, and we could see them strung out there, but they'd got our range all right. And
you said you'd been wounded earlier in Madrid.
Well, that was just a slight flesh wound on the head. When that shrapnel, when that shell went off, I got a bit of the shrapnel, but it was very minor.
Can you tell me anything about the circumstances of the killing of Cornford and Fox?
No, nothing except that, well, when we were advancing and crawling up, we had got to a crest. And it was when we got to this crest that we came under heavy fire, machine gun fire. And it was then that when I was wounded and Fox and Cornford were killed. And a lot of others, of course, were killed.
You don't have any first-hand information, but did you hear anything from your comrades about how they'd been killed?
No. So that was that. I had this period in hospital about which I told you, and then I was finally moved to Ciudad Real, and then to Albacete. But I was still walking with, well, I was out off crutches and walking with a stick though, and my foot was still in bandage. And then I worked for a bit with Peter Kerrigan, at the base headquarters in Albacete.
Doing what?
Just in the office there, handling queries and of various sorts that came. Kerrigan had been to see me in hospital, and I'd first been reported killed, and it was Kerrigan who told me about Fox and Cornford who had been killed. And I worked with him for a bit until after the Jarama battle. And then with the Jarama battle, when the casualty list came, I was sent back to England with the casualty lists of the Jarama battle.
When would that have been?
That was in February, March, 37. And it was then that I went through Barcelona and went back to Paris and England.
So you didn't return to Spain after that?
Oh, yes. Then I was in England for some while. A wound had began to give some trouble. I attended at the Hammersmith Hospital, and it was put right. I then asked to go back to Spain, and I was sent by the party to work in Paris for a bit. And I worked in Paris for a few months on the pipeline. With increasing number of volunteers coming from Britain, and my job was to see when they arrived, to meet them, go to take them to the hotel, on occasions to get some of them who'd had a bit too much to drink out of the local police station and get them onto the train to the frontier. But I got fed up with this and insisted on going back to Spain. And so I was given and told on one occasion that, well, by that time, the only way to go to Spain was across the Pyrenees. I obviously couldn't make it with the wound I was doing. So I was told that well, I had a job to do. A French comrade said that there were a number of women who were going to Spain as nurses of different nationalities, and that I was to go down to Perpignan, and comrades there would tell me what was required. Well, I got to Perpignan and told me that there were various women who were in various places. I had to collect them and went to Narbonne, Carcassonne, Béziers, Montpellier, found these various women and brought them back. And then I was told that, well, they were going to be got to Spain by a fishing boat. So one day I went to, I was introduced to a comrade whose fishing boat it was, and we got these girls down to the boat, which was in a small fishing village at that time called Agde, A-G-D-E, which now has become an enormous holiday complex. But at that time it was a small fishing village. And we got the girls on board, and well, after various alarms and excursions, we got to Spain. I said goodbye to the girls. There was one girl in particular who I, you know, got to know quite well, and well, I've known her now. It's a Polish Jewish girl who had gone to Palestine as a Zionist. Palestine, as it then was, as a Zionist, and become a communist in Palestine. Had been in prison, expelled, and then finished up in France, and then went to Spain.
What was her name?
Dora Levin, her name is now, and her name at that time was Dora Birnbach. And she was a nurse in Spain, did fantastic work, and finished up, well, tragically, because she was here during the war, worked with the International Federation of Seamen, International Union of Seamen, and went back to Poland after the war, and as a member of the Polish Communist Party, worked in Gdynia Gdańsk, the whole business of rebuilding, or building really, a Polish shipping industry, and became victim of the anti-Semitic campaign in Poland in 1968 period. And it's now, then came back in Israel, and it's a tragic fact that the largest group of Polish international brigaders today are in Israel. There were, as we say in the party, comrades of Jewish origin, who in the end had nowhere to go except Israel, which was the last place they wanted to go. It's really one of those tragic outcomes of what the Polish Communist Party denies ever happened. But in fact, it was an anti-Semitic campaign at that time, and these comrades of Jewish origin had no alternative but to get out of Poland. But still, say, these girls, when we got to Spain in this fishing boat, and they went on their way, I went on to Barcelona and was reported to the party there, went to a medical board and was found unfit for the army, and was instructed to report for work at the broadcasting work. And so I arrived there one day in July 37, at the place, the building where it was a former house, where the foreign language broadcasts were. There was a German comrade in charge of they were broadcasting in German, Italian, French, English at the time, I think Portuguese as well. And I was told, well, you're on the air tonight at 7 o'clock. I'd never even confronted a typewriter before. They said, well, there's your desk, there's your typewriter. The first item on the broadcast every night is the military communique. There it is in Spanish, translated. You're on the air, 7 o'clock tonight. And that was how I was pitchforked, more or less, into my career of crime as a journalist, which I've been since. I worked on the radio and on these broadcasts, first, as I said, for the central Spanish government broadcasts, and then also for the Catalan government broadcasts. Until, then Bill Rust came out as the Daily Worker correspondent and also British Communist Party representative there, and I worked with him as a sort of general dog's body while continuing my work as on the radio and as an interpreter at times, translating, going along in the morning to help him with looking at the Spanish newspapers and that sort of thing. And then when Bill Rust left and Peter Kerrigan took over as Daily Worker correspondent and British Communist Party representative, I worked very closely with Peter as well. And when Peter left to return home, I took over as Daily Worker correspondent, then stopped the radio work. Radio was then handed over to a comrade called Frank Graham. And I was Daily Worker correspondent there right to the bitter end. I mean, I left Barcelona the day before the fascists took over, January the 26th, 1939.
Can you describe what Barcelona was like in the last days?
It was terrible. There was a general... there was a general demoralisation all round. I had been in touch, naturally I was phoning my stories from Barcelona to the Daily Worker, and as the situation got worse, I asked Springall, who was then the editor of the Daily Worker. One was never clear in those days who the hell was the editor, but anyhow, he was the one I spoke to. And Springall, who had been a political commissar with the British Battalion, said, well, stay until the last minute. Well, that was all very well, Springall sitting on his arse in London saying, stay at the last minute. And I had a talk with William Forrest, who had become the Daily the News Chronicle correspondent there. Geoffrey Cox had left the Express, the News Chronicle, and then joined the Express, but he didn't come back to Spain. Willie Forrest was then sent as the News Chronicle correspondent at the time. Well, Willie Forrest told me that he'd been out the previous day outside Barcelona. Well, no, that's right. I had gone out with Willie Forrest a few days before. I've forgotten actually when it was, but it was early January 39. And he had powerful binoculars, and we could see the fascists advancing, and there was nothing to stop them. And we looked around, and on the way back, there was nothing in the way of trenches or defences being built at all. Well, at that time, I was also reckoned to be the British Communist Party representative in Barcelona. It was a very... sort of rather nebulous thing. Well, what really it consisted of was when comrades who were going home from the British Battalion, I was asked to help them when I could, so they would look me up. And there was, for instance, occasions when some body of the Catalan government authorities would suddenly decide that it was they who controlled the frontier of France, and not the central government. Well, Catalonia is on the borders with France. So occasionally when this sort of thing happened, to get your exit papers, you had to go and get not only a central government piece of paper, but a Catalan government piece of paper. And I was in touch with the Spanish and Catalan parties, and as such knew had a pass to go in and out of the building. And during that time got to know Tagliati, or at that time was known in Spain as Ercole, and also the Comintern, and he was the Comintern advisor to the Spanish party. And I also got to know quite well the Comintern